The harder they come, the harder they fall, which is my wish for the subject of today's program, AIPAC. Grant Smith is one of the country's foremost investigative journalists and one of its best-kept secrets, since the focus of his work has been on uncovering the hidden history of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, Israel's officially registered Washington lobby and the most powerful foreign policy advocate in the nation's capital. As Director of Research of the Washington-based Institute for Research in Middle East Policy, or IRMEP, he has produced four fact-filled books: Deadly Dogma, How Neoconservatives Broke the Law to Deceive America in 2006, which we spoke with him about when he was last on Takes on the World; Foreign Agents, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, from the 1963 Fulbright hearings to the current scandal in 2007, Declassified Deceptions, A Secret History of Isaiah Kennan and the Rise of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, also in 2007, and now his latest, America's Defense Line, the Justice Department's Battle to Register the Israel Lobby as Agents of a Foreign Government, a battle which the government lost. If the name of Cy Kennan and what he meant by the current scandal, what is meant, and that's not an accident. If you don't know what that means, you're not supposed to know about them, but you will find out this morning from my guest. Welcome to Takes on the World again, Grant Smith.
Hi, Jeffrey. It's great to be here, and thanks for having me back.
Well, glad to have you back. I know how difficult it has been for you to get any kind of voice on this particular issue, given the pandering that politicians at every level of American society afford Israel and its supporters. At the beginning of my program this morning, I noted that the only U.S. ally mentioned in the presidential and vice presidential debates thus far has been Israel, and all the candidates have either expressed or implied their willingness to have American soldiers expend their lives and U.S. taxpayers even more of their dollars in defending it, while our relations with a country that has been long vital to U.S. interests in both economic and human terms, Mexico, and to whom a far greater percentage of Americans trace their heritage, has been totally ignored. How much does the Israel lobby, and specifically AIPAC, the organization you have been investigating and writing about, have to do with that?
Well, it has a great deal to do with that. And I think the fact that the candidates themselves are raising it so repeatedly is giving Americans an excellent chance to see something that normally is discussed more behind closed doors. But the fact that particularly in the last presidential debates, you see this carte blanche commitment of U.S. Military forces to Israel, and also the fact that there are few to no differences between either candidate gives some Americans a glimpse. But as you've mentioned, we've done a number of reports on AIPAC, and this is an organization we consider to have done some extremely harmful things to the United States, whether you mentioned in passing the 2005 indictment of two of its executives for espionage, which has not yet gone to trial, but there's a strong case for that, curiously enough, in an effort to motivate the U.S. to take a tougher line on Iran, whether it's the 1988 Political Action Committee coordination scandal, in which the Washington Post revealed that AIPAC was against its corporate charter, attempting to coordinate donations to candidates, whether it's the 1984 free trade agreement, in which the FBI revealed that AIPAC had obtained secret International Trade Commission documents that it was using to negotiate against the United States government and private industry for a free trade deal that has given the U.S. a $63 billion trade deficit, where before 1884 it was roughly in parity. All of these things are gradually coming to light, particularly as Americans are more aware that they may have dodged a bullet briefly with the H.R. 362 defeat, which would have been a congressional resolution, an act of war against Iran.
Yeah, I mentioned that earlier, yes. Continue.
Okay, well, so what we've done is we've been really going back and trying to figure out how this organization has been able to essentially act as if it were had transcended U.S. law. And an investigation that we started a couple of years ago with a multitude of Freedom of Information Act filings with major U.S. government agencies finally yielded, both in March and June of this year, over 1,000 documents which were previously classified, which revealed a secret battle that was going on back in the early 1960s between the American Zionist Council, which is AIPAC's predecessor organization, and the United States Department of Justice. What we did in particular was obtain documents, internal Department of Justice documents, which revealed a curious deal which had taken place between the DOJ in 1965, and I'd like to just give a little bit of background about what was going on at that point, if there's time.
Please do.
Okay. Well, in 1961, Senator J.W. Fulbright was feeling the pressure coming from many sides to do things in terms of aids and arms to support the various groups in the United States lobbying for Israel, which were somewhat limited at that point in time. He was particularly focused on Isaiah Cannon and his lobbying newsletter, The Near East Report, because it was raising a lot of grassroots opposition and media, tactical media opposition to peace initiatives in the region. So he launched a team in 1961 and 1962 to investigate where the AZC was getting its money. And to summarize the investigation, they were getting it from entities in Israel via the Jewish Agency, which is an international global organization with a headquarters in Jerusalem.
Which is actually designed to get Jews, initially Jews, to move to Israel.
Right. But it's since its beginning, it transmogrified into basically a shadow government with a 1953 covenant agreement with the Israeli government, which gave it a great deal of power, the ability to get tax revenue and all sorts of funding power in the state. Fulbright discovered that they had funneled basically $5 million to various grassroots organizations through the AZC, which itself was an umbrella organization for Hadassah and the Zionist Organization of America and a few other organizations, to really get all of these grassroots units across the U.S. fired up, funded, and able to generate the massive pressure on Congress and massive pressure on the media whenever things like the peace initiatives came up. Also, at the same time, as you'll recall, there were a number of initiatives, particularly by President Kennedy, to look into the Dimona nuclear weapons facility that was being constructed in Israel. And in fact, he specifically sent a letter to the new prime minister on July 5th of 1963, demanding that they allow U.S. inspections of that facility. So there was a lot of effort as well, particularly by AIPAC's founder, Isaiah Cannon, to steer U.S. attention away from that and not allow those inspections to happen. In this milieu of, post-Cuban missile crisis, a huge amount of disruption, particularly after Kennedy was assassinated, there was this ongoing secret battle that was going on, which, again, we found out about only through government document releases in June, in which the Department of Justice Internal Security Unit actually formally demanded that the AZC register as the foreign agents of the Jerusalem Agency in Jerusalem for having done all of this lobbying with foreign dollars. What was surprising was the amount of pressure that was then brought to bear on the Justice Department, such that after years of battling and after years of valiant efforts by DOJ officials like Irene Bowman and a few others, they were basically prohibited from actually enforcing FARA, which, again, to back up, is a 1938 law requiring any foreign agent to fully disclose in a public office all of their lobbying, all of their financial transfers, all of their movements in the United States if they're receiving directed foreign funding. But after Kennedy was assassinated and after Nicholas Katzenbach became Attorney General, they actually allowed the AZC to file some sort of pro forma reports. And they did disclose some of the people in institutions that had received the funding, such as, you know, professors, people churning out books, people in media who were acting as consultants, and a number of other very interesting issues. But that part of their filing was classified and was never, in fact, released. It was the first, as we call it, non-public public FARA declaration in the history of the Justice Department. What's revealed in the notes, the memos, the urgent discussions with the FBI about whether or not to raid the AZC and whether or not to turn over the entire file to a grand jury, was the fact that they were trying to enforce this law, which had successfully been used against the Soviet Union and some of their operations in the United States. It had been used against the Dominican Republic for their lobbying for the Philippines. But this time, they lost. This time, they weren't able to actually uphold rule of law because after the Johnson administration came in, there was suddenly this massive top-down directive to wind it up. And they did wind it up, and so did the AZC. After holding one more bash after the secret filing in 1965, they dismantled their operations and shifted them over to AIPAC. And it's interesting because this has always been a very murky subject area. If you look at AIPAC's website or any literature about it, they will talk about how they emerged from a boutique of lobbying organizations in the 60s as though it were, you know, a flower shop or something. Well, that's not how AIPAC began. AIPAC began because its predecessor organization was shut down and some of the umbrella groups were so traumatized at the prospect of being actually held to account for their activities that they had to reorganize and decentralize and put AIPAC in charge of lobbying Congress and the executive, but be more careful. But, you know, the history, this part of the history has never actually been discussed for lack of documentary evidence.
Well, there have been efforts by former members of Congress and former people in the State Department to get Israel to register. There's been actually efforts made to do this. And what has happened to those efforts?
Well, those efforts, you know, there was a very interesting one, again, back in 1988 after the Washington Post disclosed that it was coordinating PACs. They were actually State Department, former State Department officials who were asking it to disclose more information about its donors because it was operating as a political action committee. But all of these efforts have typically... That one lasted 10 years and was finally, it went to the Supreme Court. They didn't address the real core issues around it and faded away. The organization, after the 1965 showdown, emerged with this kind of Teflon attitude. And the Department of Justice, quite frankly, has been extremely reticent to investigate or challenge it because of this institutional history that nobody knew about. Inside the Department of Justice, they call this deal the caveat. The caveat is that this organization is basically going to be treated differently because if you do go after it, because of its unique and enduring relations, usually with the president, there can be a top-down effort made to shut you down, and typically people who have pursued it have quickly found out that it's not, as they would say, internally, they don't have the political capital to actually enforce rule of law when it comes to this particular organization.
Well, it could be a career-ending decision. I remember Strobe Talbott in 1981, I believe, who was an editor and a Soviet expert, was the editor of Time magazine and wrote a scathing critique of Israel in Time magazine saying that it was not a strategic asset, there's a myth that it is, but history shows it hasn't been. It's been a liability. So he wrote a very strong critique of Israel, and then under the Clinton administration, he came up for, he was nominated to be Deputy Secretary of State, and he had to do, it was like an inquisition. They brought this comment, this editorial up, and he had to do a mea culpa and apologize and say he had been wrong, and that Israel was a strategic asset. We see it yesterday in these debates playing out.
Right. Everyone's reading from a script, and of course, some of the things that you'd actually need to discuss within the context, for example, of all of this effort to demonize and portray Iran as now an imminent threat to the United States, some of the key factors you'd have to discuss go right back to this period. Well, what about Israel's nuclear weapons? What about, you know, the fact that Jimmy Carter is the first former president to confirm that, yes, in fact, they do have their own arsenal, an arsenal, by the way, which many of the people around these earlier lobbies were active in financing and diverting attention from? How can you have a discussion about regional nonproliferation if you don't even acknowledge the fact that this country actually has its own substantial arsenal? So the fact that you can't be open or discuss any of these is making debate and making the presidential discussion of regional policy otherworldly, to say the least.
Well, it finally did get mentioned in the Security Council, but you know it will never be mentioned by a member of Congress or one of the presidential candidates.
Or the media.
Or the mainstream media. Once in a while they'll have an article, but there'll be no follow-up and no editorial comment on it. Some of the stories you have are really, I mean, I've known a lot about the lobby, but reading your books have been an eye-opener. One of the things that you go into is the Fulbright hearing. Senator Fulbright, who is famous for the Fulbright scholarships,
right,
was someone who really recognized the liability of Israel to U.S. foreign policy and the lobby to American democracy, and he was one of the first to openly criticize the lobby. What happened to him? Tell us about those hearings and what happened to Fulbright.
Well, his hearings were monumental because basically he sent two investigators, James Sifton and Walter Pincus, who's now at the Washington Post, to go and gather all of these documents proving the fact that there was massive money laundering into the United States of all sorts of funds to lobby the Congress for these initiatives, which Kennan himself would admit when he started all of this was not for the U.S. It was because Israel needed arms and funding. So he was a former antitrust lawyer at the Justice Department and a real stickler for rule of law. He really wanted to understand where all of this fundraising was coming from, because I think he knew that this was jump-starting something that would, in fact, never go away if it were allowed to actually violate the Foreign Agents Registration Act. That if this took hold in the United States and this lobbying, this constant lobbying of the executive was allowed to continue as if it were a special case, I think he knew what would happen. Basically, he was very penetrating in his analysis and his discussions. He was also in coordination with the Justice Department. The Justice Department was writing memos saying, well, much depends on Fulbright and his hearings, because they, in fact, were receiving most of their evidence from this 1963 hearing. There were two sessions that looked into the Israel question, one in May and one in August. Initially, a lot of the internal documents, et cetera, were not put into the Senate record, but they did quickly become available, and all sorts of newspaper articles subsequently came out. This made Fulbright an enemy. Kennan, Isaiah Kennan, the leader of AIPAC, was soon publishing highly negative articles. But what Fulbright was able to do is he actually brought President Kennedy over to his side of the issue. 1 month before he was assassinated, he was talking about the fact that it was unrealistic to be constantly attaching all of these lobby-generated provisions to regional aid and other packages because they would cause the Arab governments basically to walk away. And so both at this point, Fulbright and Kennedy were both considered to be huge threats to these lobbying initiatives. And it was a key moment. It was a culmination of so many things that we can now see more clearly by looking at what was going on in the Justice Department.
Well, actually, Kennedy had some surprises when he was elected president and was confronted by a man named Abe Feinberg,
right,
unknown to most listeners, but a major player in the Zionist lobby. Maybe you could tell a little bit about that, who Abe Feinberg was.
Well, Abraham Feinberg was a very successful businessman in New York who began lobbying President Truman and was a key ally to Isaiah Kennan back in the 40s to jumpstart a direct relationship between presidents and the key money people in the lobby. You see this repeated today, except the names have changed. You know, now you have Chaim Savan funding AIPAC and doing a lot of contributions on the Democratic side, Sheldon Adelson on the Republican side. Feinberg was basically doing that, except before anybody else was, making sure that the money was flowing. For Truman, in fact, he was the one behind putting together the whistle stop campaign in 1948 for Truman's election campaign that basically brought him out of sure defeat to Dewey, who was his competitor, and into victory by having massive amounts of funding in recognition for his recognition of the fledgling state of Israel by groups across the United States who wanted to see that one-on-one relationship continue. Feinberg was intimate with Truman. He, in fact, when Truman decided not to run again, was kind of the one who knew before anybody else and met with the press to discuss his personal private meetings with Truman. So he was just intimately involved with the administration and, in fact, instrumental in installing something that is not very visible to most Americans. Most Americans only get glimpses of lobbying initiatives that happen directly with the president. And one of our contentions about Feinberg and about policy formulation regarding Israel in general is some of the most major initiatives, when they are in play, are not readily accessible to the American public to evaluate until, on average, about four decades after they actually happened, and the moment to influence or even comment has long since passed. But in this case, by the time Johnson was taking over and considering his own reelection campaigns, which was, again, dovetailing with this investigation into the AZC, he was receiving massive amounts of cash from Feinberg. In fact, it even caused a problem when one of his aides was caught soliciting in a public bathroom, and Bill Moyers, his trusted aide, and another had to go and remove several hundreds, thousands of dollars of Feinberg's cash from a safe for the reelection campaign. And Moyers has mentioned that in passing a few times, where he says, well, there's a lot of money in Washington in those days, not too much campaign contribution laws. But this man is an amazing figure, and he has commented for the Truman Library about parts of his role in what was a massive arms smuggling network for the initial arming of Israel and the Haganah. He was instrumental, according to Seymour Hersh, in making sure that the nuclear weapons program was financed. And if you think about the fact that a lot of the people he recommended became appointees in the Johnson administration, while he was simultaneously engaged in financing one of the most destabilizing acts of proliferation in the Middle East, you begin to get a sense for how out of touch the public debate on these types of issues is, particularly when, again, you can only begin discussing them with facts and documentary evidence about four decades after the moment to influence something has passed.
Well, even you have been investigating this, and yet very rarely do we see anything in the media. I do recall just after the AIPAC annual conference in which Barack Obama, John McCain, and Hillary Clinton competed to see who was I Love Israel the Most award, which prompted actually John Stewart on The Daily Show to make a very funny parody of the event. Arnaud de Borchgrave, a veteran Washington columnist who's the editor-in-large of the Washington Times, wrote about how it's an act of not homage but fealty for every American politician, whether the or aspiring politician, candidate for president or congressman, any level, to pledge their fealty, their loyalty to Israel as a rite of passage. And these come, you know, these statements are made occasionally. You find them in the media, and then they're not picked up.
No.
And they're not even picked up by the so-called left. You know, the anti-war movement also ignores them as well, choosing to place all the blames on the back of good old U.S. imperialism.
Right.
And not see that much of U.S. imperialism, particularly in terms of the Middle East, is guided by directly by the hands of the Israel lobby. The time, by the way, is 9:46. My guest is Grant Smith, who is the author of a number of books, the latest being America's Defense Line, the Justice Department's Battle to Register the Israel Lobby as Agents of a Foreign Government. If you have any comments or questions for Grant, the number here is 895-2448, 1-800-499-7117. To give some kind of an idea of the power of the lobby, in the spring there was an old Jewish man arrested back in New York, New Jersey, named Ben Ami Kadosh, who it turns out had been spying for Israel. And the story was in the paper. He had been run by the same handler who had Jonathan Pollard, and yet there's not been a single story on Ben Ami Kadosh since that time.
Right. It reveals, I think, the schism between law enforcement and the executive. I think the fact that they reactivated, when they found him talking to his handler, reactivated an espionage probe dating back to the days of Jonathan Pollard against Kadosh, is more reflective of the fact that law enforcement officials at the front line, what I would call America's defense line in terms of rule of law, are eager to prosecute these cases when they come across them, and they weren't particularly out to get this person, but he simply, due to contacts with his handler, revealed that he was instrumental, potentially or allegedly, in espionage against the United States. I think it's also interesting, another story that quickly faded, when Chaim Saban, who again has pumped millions into AIPAC and also the DNC, was found or alleged by four people in the nonprofit sphere to have offered them $1 million in exchange for a couple of them who were super delegates to switch their vote to Hillary Clinton. And this was because Saban has been carrying a group of different lobbyists and helping insert them into government, such as Martin Indyk, Dennis Ross, Kenneth Pollack, and was obviously vying for influence. Well, if that had happened, for example, to Acorn or one of these grassroots voter registration nonprofits, which, by the way, I guess they were raided this morning, but if it had happened to any other person or organization, I think we would have seen some traction in terms of investigations or FEC actions to show that this is a clean election. But again, as you noted, there's radio silence.
Radio silence. You have a couple of calls here. Let's go to the first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning,
Grant. This
morning.
Is Bill from Philo. Let me start by injecting a little historical footnote since we had the debates last night. I believe it was John McCain's father, Admiral McCain, who was tasked with investigating the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty
yes.
in 1957 and basically squelched and covered up the whole thing. He was probably ordered to by Johnson. Nevertheless, he never went on the record publicly after that too much to talk about how the whole thing stunk. But my question for you, Grant, is my understanding is that polls in America have shown that the majority of Jews in America do not support the radical Zionist agenda of AIPAC or the present Israeli administrations. And there has recently been a new group formed here in the States, and I forget their name.
J Street.
To try and counter the influence of AIPAC. I wonder if you could talk about that and how you see that shaking out. Thanks very much, Bill.
I think you hit it spot on. In fact, there have been a number of polls, which if you interpret the numbers, they tend to verify exactly what you say, which is that the majority, as polled by some polling organizations have shown that there isn't broad grassroots support, that there wasn't support for the Iraq War, that there is no support within the community for bombing Iran, et cetera, et cetera. But that's been the case since the beginning. Since the beginning, there's always been this rather broad grassroots constituency and then this razor-thin operational organization which actually determines policy and which actually moves the money around. In fact, Glenn Greenwald came out with his own analysis of a 2007 opinion poll by the American Jewish Council, which we cite in the book, talking about how the position, particularly of the neoconservative wing of the lobby, has been consistently rejected within their own polls. And, in fact, the whole so-called war on terrorism, they view that as being largely harmful marketing. So what you say, Bill, is absolutely right, and there are efforts. But what we've seen consistently is that the elite movement to have direct one-on-one relationships between the president and, again, the Sheldon Adelsons and Chaim Sabans and the elite members of AIPAC and the ZOA has always tended to win out. And it's rather like the whole neoconservative movement, which is smart, razor-thin, basically unrepresentative of any grassroots constituency, managing to take hold and directive policy. And that's a real danger.
Thanks for the question, and good question and answer. And we have two more callers. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
You're on the air.
That's Jeff. Jim Houle, Redwood Valley. Oh, I wondered whether your guest could comment on the fact that with the decline in American imperialist power as a result of this financial collapse, Israel is going to feel the need to take an early initiative in its hegemonic battle with Iran for control in the Middle East.
Good question.
Yeah, excellent question. We John Podhoretz, who's a very influential person in terms of neoconservative ideology, and his father, Norman, have both staked out the idea that the Bush administration, and they assume that there won't be a new Republican administration, needs to strike Iran between Election Day and the inauguration of the new president, precisely to make that direct Israeli-Iran action unnecessary. And I think there's a definite high level of danger that he, in fact, will do that. Haven't seen any movement to establish the direct diplomatic relationships, which Condoleezza Rice apparently had put on the table and which surfaced in the media, and then were immediately, nothing's happened with that. I think we're entering a period, an extremely dangerous period, over the next few months.
I wanted to get back to the moment. I agree with you there. I think it might be that Israel might do it, although this economic collapse has also made it a liability in terms of fundraising for Jewish organizations, for American Jews. Many of the donors are heavily invested in Wall Street and lost a bundle. Sheldon Adelson was until recently the third richest man in the world. He is now the 15th and has had to cut his funding for some Jewish organizations in order to bail out some of his own properties like giving $500 million to the Sands Hotel, which he owns, to prevent it from collapsing. We do have a caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. I think people really need to understand the meaning of 9/11. It's the date of the Balfour Declaration. And during World War One, the British government and allies asked Palestine to fight on the side of the allies against the Ottoman Empire. In exchange, they were guaranteed to be free of any foreign rule. Behind their back, the head of the Zionist movement, Lord Rothschild, was pumping money to the British government to come up with this unlawful declaration, 9/11 of 1923, that was the beginning of the division or the partition of Palestine. This is like if I went to somebody behind your back and sold them your land. This is at the root of the whole thing. And the fact that our representatives put the interests of a foreign state before the interests of the American people, they should be dismissed. And AIPAC should just be outlawed. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. The origin of the Balfour Declaration is an interesting one. There's another theory that it was a gift to the Zionists in order to get the U.S. into the war on the side of England at the time. England was about to lose to Germany, and the Zionists lobbying here in the United States to get President Wilson to go back on his word. It's a very complicated subject, and there's a lot of history in it, like history of AIPAC, and no one's around here now like Grant Smith to dig it out.
Well, I don't think you have to even go into these theories about coincidental dates and numbers. I think what you have to do is look at the documentary evidence. It's out there. It can be summarized. And as she has alluded to, there's a lot of uncomfortable information which tends not to make it out into the consciousness, much less affect any policy decisions whatsoever. So, but I would say that looking at coincidental digits and dates is not... You don't need to do that. All you have to do is look at the history, particularly the new histories based on newly emerged documents.
We have one time for one quick caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. Let me turn the radio off. A couple of quick observations and a question. As to the best of my knowledge, we are the only country that has ever used the bomb on anyone else.
True.
That's one. Two, there's a lot of bellicose noise being made about Iran having the bomb and how important it is to stop them. And the question, where did Israel get the fissionable material that they used to make their bomb? And I'll bail out now. Thank you.
Thanks very much for your call.
Well, if you read Seymour Hersh's book, The Samson Option, his theory... based on investigation, is that there was a diversion at sea of some licensed ore purchased between Germany and Italy. But that almost doesn't matter. What matters, I think, is that the U.S., and particularly Kennedy, who was the father of the non-proliferation regime, which was a brilliant piece of legislation which had, by the way, requirements of both nuclear weapons holders and aspirants to be open and reduce stockpiles on the part of those who had them, were completely torpedoed, and now it seems have been completely shunted to the side with the case of India, etc. But the fact that you can't even mention in detail and talk about the stockpile and capabilities of the only country in the region with nuclear arms is extremely unhelpful, to say the least.
Grant, I want to stop you there because I want people to know how to get a hold of your book. Now, I'm going to give the website is www.irmep.org, and your phone is 202-342-7325. That's correct?
That's correct. The book is on sale. The hardcover is on sale at both Amazon and Barnes & Noble and other stores. People can get advanced releases of the new paperback for $14.95 at MiddleEastBooks.com.
I would also, actually, we have a number of good local bookstores in the county, and I always try to get my listeners to go to those bookstores and ask them to order these books so people at the bookstores can actually see the book, and they may pay a few dollars more, But it's good that the bookstores get the business as well as seeing what their customers are ordering.
Absolutely.
And maybe they think they'll put it out on the shelf.
Well, that'd be good. And they can definitely order them through the Ingram online catalog. It's the, one of the dominant bookseller distribution networks in the world. So there is no scarcity. It's available.
Just the scarcity of information about the book.
That's true, and I appreciate your putting out the message. I think that the document release and what we've put into this book is going to be surprising to people on all sides of the issue.
Okay, Grant, we got to go now. Thank you so much, Grant Smith, for being my guest today, author of America, the last book, America's Defense Line, the Justice Department's Battle to Register the Israel Lobby as Agents of a Foreign Government. Get it. It's an eye-opener. And thanks very much, Grant, for being our guest today.
Thanks, Jeff.
Take care. And that finishes it up for me. It Takes on the World. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks to all for listening, and thanks to all the callers who called in. Joy LeClaire will be in the seat next week, and I'll actually be back here in 2 weeks for the fundraising drive, and hope you will show your support for me and the station. You have been listening, of course, to Takes on the World on KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, 88.1 FM Fort Bragg. We're going to go now to Earth and Sky, followed by the Pittsburgh Symphony.